In this episode of Registry Matters, we're brought to you by our rockstar patrons, Justin, Brian, Michael, Aaron, and Ronald. Your pledges make all the difference. Let's roll.
I hope I can remember how to do this since we haven't done it in 3 weeks. Recording live! Well, it was 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 347. I thought it was 348, but this is 347 of Registry Matters. Larry Fine, sir, how are you?
I'm nice and toasty. How are you?
Nice and toasty. How's God? Every year we do this, and you know, it's like all we ever talk about is the weather. But tell me, how freaking hot is it?
It's actually not that bad. It's only 92, but the air conditioning system that's supposedly new is failing again, so it's getting beyond the zone of comfort for me.
And riddle me this. Are you on, like, the 40th floor of your building?
I'm on the top floor, so I'm on the second floor.
Oh, okay. But still, heat rises.
Yeah, there's plenty of it coming from this place.
Especially coming out of your big face hole. Spewing all that heat coming out of that mouth. Tell us what we're doing tonight.
Well, we are doing a little bit of this and that. Chance was unable to join us, apparently. He called, and then I didn't reconnect with him, so it means it's just Mr. Doom and Gloom. We have a case.
I guess we'll have to make do with that then, won't we?
I guess so. We have a case from the New Mexico Supreme Court that's a disaster for PFRs. Also, we have a comment left on YouTube by a listener to unpack, and a question about PFR rules in Tennessee. And then I think you've got some kind of surprise for the audience coming up.
And all right, well then, let's jump right in. So the first one coming up here would be this YouTube comment, and it says, "You state," which I would guess we state, "you state on your website that the registry is constitutional because we register cars, dogs, cats, etc. This is incorrect. We register things, not people. In order to be compelled to report to the police, the state must have a court order. Without a court order, they cannot compel you to report to the police." Interesting point. I'm pretty sure, Larry, we register other things than things.
I'm sure we do, but it's interesting how this got taken out of context. I don't say the registry is constitutional because we register cars and other things. What I do say that's being taken out of context is that when we're doing a facial unconstitutionality challenge, which in order for something not to be able to be done, period, it has to be facially unconstitutional. And I have said for the 8 years we've been doing this program, that the registry is not facially unconstitutional because there are sets of circumstances that would exist which would make registering PFRs constitutional. You could very well create a constitutional registry. So the commenter is wrong about that. I'm not saying the registry is constitutional. I believe that in most instances, the registry as it exists in the U.S. and most of our states is blatantly unconstitutional. But I'm saying you can't mount a facial constitutional challenge because a court will never rule that there are no set of circumstances by which you can register PFRs. And that's what a facial constitutional challenge would look like to end it all. And that is not in the offing. But to unpack his point, we do register cars and things, but we register more than cars and things. We register young men between 18 and 26. I think you've got one in your household.
He's definitely between 18 and 26.
And we register them for the secret, for the Selective Service. Has he registered for the Selective Service?
I just literally just now reminded him, sent him a message saying, "Hey, you got to fill that thing out." And he's like, "What in the world is that?" And I gave him the paperwork, but I'm sure it is under another pile of other things, and he has no idea what to do with it. Do you know, can you go like online to a website somewhere and do it, or do you have to fill out that form?
It's been quite some time since that process started. It used to be you could pick up the forms at your post office, but it would seem logical you could do it online today. But young men between the ages of 18 and 26, not young men and women, but young men between 18 and 26, register for Selective Service. And if they don't register, they're subject to a 5-year term of imprisonment and a large fine, forfeiture of student financial aid, and a whole lots of consequences if they don't register. Now, I don't hear a lot of moms complaining about their kid getting 5 years in prison, so I think it's very unlikely that that would, has been or would be imposed, but it's on the books. But we register voters, which is a constitutional right, but you still have to register. We register school children. I mean, but we register all sorts of people. For the person to say that we don't register people, I just don't know what universe that person lives on, because we register a lot of people for a lot of things. The and question for the...
Go.
Go ahead.
If we go the other direction, though, about... like, if you just had to fill out the paperwork online or in a postcard thing that says, I still live at this address, and mail it in, and that was you registering for your PFR registration statute, I don't think anybody would ever complain about it. Like, I mean, somebody would. I'm sure somebody would, as far as just the complaint of, God, I have to do this thing every year. But that is not, as you'll call it, a disability and restraint. It's the having to go get your fingerprints and get the picture taken and get your car registered and all these other things on top of it. That's where all the pain in the ass comes in.
Correct. And the advance notice of things that you're going to do before you do them, like before you operate a vehicle in some states, I think you have to notify them at the registry office, and you have to do these things in person. So, but the early versions of the registries around the country, even in Alabama, the early first version of registration required very little in the way of involvement from the PFR. But as time has grown, we're in second, third, fourth generation of registries. But this person is sorely mistaken about what I'm saying. So I wanted to clarify that if this person's mistaken, other people are mistaken. I'm not saying that the registry is constitutional. I'm saying that it's not facially unconstitutional. I could design you a registry that would be completely constitutional. Therefore, the courts will never order that you can't register people, because you can register people. We register people all the time.
I'm with you. Big Mike is like, you don't have to register to vote if you are not going to vote. You don't go to prison for not registering to vote. He's speaking of all of the penalties for failure to register.
Yes, but that's not the legal test about going to prison. There are things that you can be penalized, like the registering for the draft. You can go to prison for 5 years for failing to register for the draft.
Is there anything other than registering for the draft that would lock you up if you didn't do it?
I think probably every regulatory scheme that's out there could potentially lock you up. Driving without a license can lock you up. And not registering your vehicle can get you locked up if you do it enough times. Run around without a license plate all over the country and find out what happens to you eventually if they apprehend you enough times.
I'm certain his point's going to be there that you don't have to drive. So true.
Oh, I get the point, but that's not the legal test. The legal test is, can the courts say that you just can't register people? And the answer is no, they cannot say that, because we do register people.
Right.
And it's a test of whether or not there are any disabilities or restraints on the registration. And until we start doing litigation correctly, building cases correctly, quit moving for summary judgment without evidence, quit bringing in lawyer witnesses to testify that countermand the points we're making, we're going to keep losing.
I understand. I know what you're referring to, too. All right. So then moving along to another one. Where did this one come from?
It came from a prisoner, and his name's escaping me, but I think his name was Derek.
All right. Not that Derek, is it?
No.
Okay. Says, I'm very interested in your organization. I plan on starting one of my own when I get out. I want to join your fight in telling you of one of Tennessee's messed up laws or policies. This one of which, wherever we choose to live, all of the people living there are subject to getting their cell phone searched, which is an invasion of their privacy for being there. If they do not allow this, then I can't live there, which is an abuse of power. This is just one of the many things that have gotten way out of control. I understand that we need to let people know where we live, and I do not have a problem with that. It's just that these people in the registry department have gone mad with power. It's like they wake up thinking, let's do this now.
Well, that's correct at the end. That is exactly what happens.
They do it until they're told to stop.
But we're not aware of any law in Tennessee that permits searches of cell phones of those who live in the same residence with a registry individual. Now, let me try to make it simple and clear. We're not aware of it. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But for just merely being on the registry, that's it. You have no other obligations to the law other than being a registrant. We're not aware of that law. So our vast Tennessee audience, if we have missed that, please let us know. But I think he's likely confusing registration with probation and parole supervision. An individual who's under active supervision for a crime does not have the full protection of the Constitution. Remember, you're being punished. This does not mean that they can come in and demand access to communications device of someone who's not under their supervision, having said that. But what they can do is forbid the supervised offender from residing there. It's similar to a no weapons rule for the offender. I don't know of a supervising office anywhere that I've come in contact with that allow weapons in one of their supervised offender's residence. But they cannot prohibit the offender's family from possessing the firearms, because that's their constitutional right. But they can forbid the offender from living in the dwelling where the firearms are
present. I was just going to bring that up. Like, they can't say you can't own that gun, but they can say you can't live there where that gun is.
And I suspect that's what's happening with the phones in Tennessee. They're telling, I mean, but just think about this from a practical point of view. Let's say you've got five people in a house, and one of them is a PFR. And the supervised offenders doesn't want to be caught accessing things that the supervised offender shouldn't be accessing. Well, when they hear the loud knock at the door and every dog in the neighborhood barking, all you do is pitch your phone to one of the other people in the house.
Yep.
And then they say, well, you can't search that phone. And that would kind of neuter the tracking of the probation service if they could do that. So it would not surprise me if they say, if we come in, anybody's there, we're going to search their phones. And if not, we're not going to let you live there. I wouldn't be surprised if they're doing that. But they can't force the person to comply to a non-warranted, warrantless search. Because the person can say, you can take your search and shove it. I'm not aware of any law that would require them to surrender their constitutional right to privacy. And we've got at least a dozen listeners in Tennessee or more. Tell us about it. If we've missed it, we want to know about it, but I'm not aware of it.
All right. Well, then let's move over to what I have titled Nirvana. So I got a quick pop quiz for you before we start going on this. Have you ever heard of Nirvana?
Of course I have. I've heard of it. Kurt Cobain's band from Aberdeen, Washington in the 80s and 90s. I heard of it then. Am I on the right track?
I believe that you're on the right track. What else do you know about Nirvana?
Well, I mean, I remember Kurt Cobain vividly. Nevermind, Smells Like Teen Spirit, all sorts of good stuff. Wasn't there somebody else named Chris and Dave Grohl? And
you got that right, but I'm not referring to that one. So let's try another one.
So you mean another Nirvana, the concept? Oh, I know what you're talking about. Buddhist teaching, liberation from suffering, and casual English, a kind of imagined perfection.
All right. That's also true, but that's not what I was really talking about. I'm talking about the Nirvana fallacy. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Okay. Well, it is when people hold out for perfect conditions before acting. So they delay or dismiss real, imperfect action that's possible right now. Waiting for the ideal becomes the excuse. It's a perfect segue into an email exchange that I had with an individual. I'm on the board with Restore Georgia, and there's an individual there that I was communicating with. And so we'll call him Ron. And he wrote, quote unquote, once I'm off the registry, I'll be able to do a lot more advocacy. And I'm like, hold on, what?
Well, that's classic. I've heard that since I've been trying to do this advocacy. They say when the time is right, I'll get involved. And often that's a polite code word for not now and probably not ever.
Right, right. And so this is why it grates under my skin so bad. I was on the registry and I was also on probation, PFR probation in Georgia. I still donated. I talked with legislators. I volunteered. I showed up. I did all kinds of stuff that was related to advocacy. I even started this podcast while still on supervision and still on the registry. And I didn't wait till the time was perfect. It seemed like I could do it now. But that line from him sounds like a stall. And that's the Nirvana fallacy in action.
All right. Well, you've learned me something today. Nirvana fallacy. And yes, I can vaguely remember meeting up with you in a rundown hotel somewhere over at Virginia Avenue and in Haverhill, trying to figure out where we could have a PFR conference in Georgia. Is that about consistent with your memory?
That is exactly where we met. And so, I mean, and he didn't just say, I face constraints. He framed real advocacy as something that unlocks after he's off the registry. Like his voice only gains legitimacy then. And that's backwards. The lived experience while under the restrictions is the credibility. Now, I have a question on that. Do you think speaking with legislators while on the registry is more impactful using the language of this is how it's impacting me right now? Or would it be better after you're off the registry? And the problem even with that is how many of us will never get off the registry. So if we all waited until we were off the registry, the number of people available to do anything would be significantly lower. But what do you think about just that of if you could binary split people going to talk to legislators while on versus while off, which do you think there would be a difference in whether they're more or less impactful that way?
Well, again, perfect conditions will never exist. And I can see the hesitation. I can feel it. I felt it myself. But I don't recommend waiting to speak with legislators. Contrary to popular belief, most legislators have no idea what the registry's like. They've never thought about it until a proposal makes its way to them. The law enforcement apparatus assures them that it's constitutional, and the victim advocates are howling and demanding accountability for the perp that violated them. And most legislators have no idea what the adverse impacts are on the registrants or their families. And if you don't tell them, they won't know. Now, I'm trying to make this simple. How would they know if they're not on the registry? And if you don't tell them, how would they gain that knowledge?
They would sit there with their assistant in the office, and as you tell them you're talking about the registry, they would go Google your name and see if you're on the registry.
And they would see it on a list, but they would not know what the registry imposes on you in the way of disabilities and restraints. They would not know how it breaks up families. They would not know that you can't go to sporting events. They would not know that you can't go to your PTA meetings. There's so many things that they would not know because they've never been told. So.
Now, in my experience, so yes, Georgia law imposes genuine limits, and you are probably the most expert person in the state as far as what the Georgia rules say, but there's proximity issues as far as living and working. There are certain issues about whether you can attend churches and whatnot, and like things like that. Can you go to Six Flags or something like that? It's not an imaginary, but the limits aren't paralysis. There's a difference between I can't do everything and I won't do anything until I can do everything.
And if you model the opposite, you found lanes. Like say we met and you started immediately wanting to know what you could do. And from letters to calls to providing funding, showing up in rooms, helping us with data management. And then all that's widened and grown over time. But we were doing a podcast and you were pounding at your door, if I remember, about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yes, that was one of those Narsal in actions on Halloween when they come to do their annual shakedown, whatever. But they did a shakedown. They didn't just come in to make sure they didn't have lights on. They came in and shook me down that night. But, you know, so I did whatever I could. I started really slow. I was just listening to the Narsal calls, then stepping into volunteering. I always donate. For the entire time, I'll be transparent. I don't donate millions of dollars, but I have the entire time I've donated $5 a month for like 10 years now. And I hope my little contribution moves the needle. And Ron already has influence. He says he's respected locally, works with clergy, interacts with the sheriff and a judge. I'm thinking he's already inside circles that other people won't necessarily have access to. So why minimize that?
I don't know. Am I down here at this part right here?
You are. That's where you got to go.
Okay. Some of it is psychological self-permission needed. People script for a future moment when advocacy will feel safer or more appropriate. But structurally, the registry wants you to internalize delay. It's baked in to chill participation. And I've dealt with this for, I guess, as many years as you have, and then a few more. And it's very common. I can't do anything. And what's even more humorous to me is they tell you that I can't vote while I'm on probation. And I say, well, you don't think that if you look at the boundaries on the map, you will see that you reside within the boundaries of a district. That person represents you. And they say, but I can't vote. And I say, but they represent you. And you still get to express your views. And they say, but I can't vote. And I say, well, 50% of the people in the country can't vote. They're minors. They can't vote. Do you think that children get fairly robust representation even though they don't vote?
They sure show up on conversations I hear about with child healthcare programs or lunches. I mean, they're talked about often.
There's a lot of people who don't vote, but you are responsible for representing all the constituents who live in your district. Now, honestly, human condition's going to kick in. If you're running for re-election and you perceive that your support is not as strong as it should be, you're probably not going to spend a lot of time campaigning with children and people who can't vote, unless you're working an angle that's going to yield you votes. So you're probably not going to spend as much time with non-voters. But you don't have non-voters stamped on your face. They don't know that unless you tell them that you're not eligible to vote. There's not anything that I'm aware of in the capitals that I've been to that scans a person's forehead and says, voter, non-voter. Have you noticed anything like that in the Georgia Capitol?
I've never seen anything like that. I do wonder, though, Larry, like I don't think I communicate this one very well. If you're talking about your super, super, super local election where there's 300 people that vote, your one vote does make like a statistical difference. But when there's 70 million people that vote for one president versus the other one, one candidate versus the other one, like your one vote is one out of 70 million. Like, it's statistically insignificant. It still matters. I'm not saying it doesn't matter. It just matters a very small amount. So, like, I'm not saying your vote doesn't matter, but that's just one thing that you could go do.
It is indeed, and I'm going to push back just a little bit on the 70 million because it's 50 separate elections.
True.
Within
true,
the
true,
country.
True.
And we had an election in the year 2000, and there was a contest in Florida that was very close. And I think the Secretary of State eventually certified George W. Bush is the winner, it seems like, by roughly 500 votes.
Right.
If memory serves me correctly. Well, your one would be pretty significant if the margin was 500.
Correct. I'm with you. I totally get where you're going. But so if my gut benchmark is, if you're not using what you have now, then I'm imagining that all of a sudden when you're given all this newfound freedom of not having to register, you're not going to suddenly explode into action later. Removal won't manufacture your incentive and your discipline to go do other things.
Well, you should judge commitment by output under constraint. If you're already in rooms with decision makers while carrying the label, that's leverage. You don't need a spotless slate. You need to be focused with a mission. And believe me, these people don't have perfect backgrounds. They're in the legislatures around the country. In fact, one in Minnesota just got arrested, popped up on my newsfeed today, a state senator there, for breaking in someone's home. Now, can you admit that's funny?
To me, it feels like this is a missed opportunity. If he leaned into the discomfort now, his impact would be greater because he'd be both the messenger and evidence at the same time, if he chose to do. I know you keep speaking that you don't have to tell them that you're a PFR, but if that conversation presented itself and it were beneficial for you, then you could present yourself as being, I'm the guy, and here are the restrictions that I have placed upon me.
Well, there are instances where you should tell them that you're a PFR, but you don't automatically have to go in and say I'm a PFR. But to have credibility about the registry, you would need to disclose your status. But that's the takeaway. The registry is engineered to sap agency and stall your narrative. Now, what does that mean, sap agency? Who wrote that?
I wrote it. I wrote every word of it.
The most resonant advocacy is from within the system, not after you've escaped its reach.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
And so for anyone listening who's telling yourself, I'll get active once X happens, and that's not the former Twitter X, that's just when, you know, something happens. Recognize that as the Nirvana fallacy creeps in, start with the imperfect tools in front of you. And that's how we erode this, not by waiting for perfect weather.
Well said, and I agree.
Well, let's move along. You put this case in here that you want to discuss, and I'm not sure about it since it's from New Mexico. Like, what do you have, like 12 people that live in the entire state? So who cares?
22.
Anyway, the name of the case is Jason Aragon. Do I have that right?
You do.
All right, and that's Jason Aragon versus Richard Martinez. Now, Jason is the PFR, and Richard Martinez is the warden of the prison where Mr. Aragon is housed. Now, this sounds like to me to be something like a habeas corpus. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do.
All right, now, so I've read this numerous times, so you better be ready. And I read it again this morning while I was mowing the grass with my push mower. I'm going to put a picture up on the screen so anybody that wants to know what I was doing, that's what it looked like.
I want to see that. Let me take a look at that. How do you do that on a push mower? Let me see that. Where is that?
You got to go, Larry, if you don't, you got to click on voice channels and live stream, and then the screen should pop up.
Okay, so you actually were reading that on your push mower. How do you read it? Because you got to hold it while you're reading it, right?
The lines are going to be kind of wavy, I promise. At the end of the day, it doesn't come out clean, I promise. So here you are. It is my understanding that PFRs in New Mexico face long and indeterminate supervised parole requirements ranging from 5 to 20 years for certain PFR type offenses, and 5 years to life or more for the serious ones. Now, how is the amount of time on parole determined?
It's categorical, meaning that the person has 5 to 20 or 5 to life, depends on the offense. So there's a bucket of offenses that'll put you in the 5 to life, and there's a bucket that'll put you in the 5 to 20. But what's most important is that the PFR must serve his or her entire sentence in prison. Then, in order to determine the actual duration of supervised parole, as we call it, the parole board is required to conduct a duration review at specified intervals, in which the state attorney general has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the PFR should remain on parole. That's all it says. It doesn't say, well, how to make the determination. And that's in section 3121-10.1, subsection C. The initial duration review must be held after the PFR served 5 years of supervised parole, and if continued on parole, at 2 1/2 year intervals after that.
Okay, that seems kind of like mud, but all right, that seems straightforward. What's the problem?
Well, the problem is the mandatory statute requiring these reviews lacks a remedy if the parole board either neglects to hold the review hearings on time or fails to even conduct them all together.
Let's cover some basic background on this particular case. In March 2009, Jason Aragon entered a plea of no contest to criminal sexual contact with a child under 13 and second degree felony. Aragon was sentenced to 15 years imprisonment in the custody of the New Mexico Corrections Department, NMCD, with 12 years suspended for an actual term of 3 years imprisonment. Upon his release, Aragon was ordered to be placed on an indeterminate parole period of not less than 5 years or more than 20 years. Aragon completed his prison sentence and commenced serving parole on June 29th of 2010. However, he remained incarcerated on in-house parole until he was released into the community on August 18th, 2010. Now, what the heck is in-house parole? Is this like house arrest?
In-house parole. Well, that's a term that we've coined here for this tragic situation that many PFRs experience. In-house parole is commonly known as the time period where the inmate has completed their basic sentence. He completed the 3 years, but he's still incarcerated in the corrections department because he didn't have a satisfactory address to go into that, what should be considered mandatory supervised release or whatever you want to put on it, but it's not parole. He didn't earn it by being a good boy. He had to serve the 3 years. And then he went into a parole status, but they wouldn't let him leave prison because he didn't have the right residence, didn't have all the support that he needed. So they get to keep holding these people. And their last count, which has been a few years back, they had close to 300 people, most of them PFRs, still in prison that were serving in-house parole.
Now, I'm going to try and get this more clear. So you just said they are on parole, but they're still on parole while in prison? Do I have that right?
Unfortunately, you do. So picture that just like in the federal system, you serve, there's no more parole in the federal system. So you serve your sentence, and you can earn to 54 days a good time annually. So that shaves off the end of your sentence, but you serve all your time and then you go into a period of supervised release. Well, in the feds, they kick you out. They may put you in a federal reintegration center into a halfway house. But in New Mexico, we don't fund those type of things. So the person is obligated to find their own residence. If they don't find it, they're on parole status, but they're still serving it in prison, but it's going against their 5 to 20, but they're serving it without having the benefit of being in the community. It's a separate sentence that's mandated by law that follows the period of incarceration.
And would you say it's analogous to federal supervised release?
Correct. The only difference is the feds actually release the person when their sentence expires. New Mexico does not, because we disguise what should be named supervised release as parole.
Interesting. All right, I see. Well, then, to move along then, on January 13th of 2020, the New Mexico Public Defender filed an amended petition for a writ of habeas corpus on Aragon's behalf. The petition asserted Aragon was entitled to habeas relief because he was not afforded a duration review hearing 5 years after he started serving parole and every 2.5 years thereafter, as required by law. The petition alleged that at the time of its filing, Aragon had served 9 years, 6 months, and 25 days without any duration review hearing whatsoever. Aragon requested a writ of habeas corpus ordering his immediate release from NMCD, New Mexico Corrections Department custody, and a discharge from parole. Nearly 10 years without a review, yet the law requires a review after 5 years. Can't we put the whole Department of Corrections in prison for not following their laws?
Yes, but can you finally admit that this is funny?
That's hilarious. No, it's not funny when people have to stay locked up after their time.
Well, a law without any teeth in it or any remedy is merely nothing more than advice.
Reminds me of something. You think it's not funny. It's definitely not funny.
If we, all these brilliant people, and we design something that's been on the books for 20 plus years and there's no teeth in it, and it's 20 years later and we're still litigating, if that's not funny, then how else would you describe it?
Pathetic. It's not funny at all. It's disgusting. I see that Aragon argued in the alternative that the New Mexico Corrections Department be ordered to immediately provide him with a duration review hearing. Aragon subsequently filed a supplement to the amended petition withdrawing his request for parole hearings, stating The sole request for relief is immediate discharge from the custody of the parole board. And what did the parole board say in response?
The parole board contended that Aragon was not entitled to any relief, arguing that he was entitled to a duration review only after serving a total of 5 years of parole in the community, as opposed to in-house parole. He had some violations while in the community, I think, and the parole board invented the 5 years in the community, although it's not in the statute, but they invented that.
But then on November 30th of 2021, nearly 11 and one-half years after Aragon commenced serving parole, the district court ordered the New Mexico Corrections Department to grant Aragon an immediate duration review hearing. How did that come about?
Well, it came about through protracted litigation that yours truly was somewhat involved in an advisory role.
Shouldn't you excuse yourself? Judges do this when they have a conflict of interest? Recuse. No. You should recuse yourself from this podcast because you were involved.
Oh, well,
just kidding.
I'm kicking myself because we lost the case and they were following my playbook, and I don't like to lose. But the district court reasoned that the initial 5 years of supervised parole that triggers the initial review hearing required by Section 312110 refers to all parole served, including in-house. And the district court denied Aragon's request for immediate release and discharge because it, quote, was not willing to go so far as to rule the corrections department had waived their right to continue to detain him by not having a review hearing. So the district judge split the baby, saying, hey, you're entitled to a hearing. But that's all he did.
All right. And so this does sound quite like a lot of mess. So what happened next?
Well, the state appealed the district court's order challenging whether parole under Section 312110 includes in-house parole. The issue, which was then pending in another case called Thompson. And Thompson had not been settled. This case has been going on pre-resolution by Thompson. But the court held this case in abeyance pending the decision in Thompson. And after Thompson was decided, that went in our favor, they decided that parole under 312110.1 includes in-house parole. Then the abeyance was vacated, and they ordered that Aragon's case be placed on the general calendar. Now, I'm going to sidetrack it a little bit here to make something funny about Thompson. Thompson's case was decided by a district judge up in San Juan County, which is the county seat is Farmington. That's the northwest conservative part of the state. And the old crusty conservative judge, when they made the argument that he had to be supervised, you know, that the statute contemplated that the person be supervised, the judge there said, well, I can't think of a place where someone is supervised more closely than in prison.
Right.
I mean, that's a pretty good comeback. He said, and he put that in his written order. He said, I can't think of a place where someone gets more tightly supervised than in prison.
That would be true. Now, since Aragon wanted to be discharged from parole, I'm assuming he appealed to the district court's decision?
Correct, he did. The parties agreed that the parole board granted Aragon a belated duration review hearing as ordered by the district court. But he was not discharged from parole, so that didn't satisfy the situation.
And then Aragon, he appealed, asserting he is entitled to a complete discharge from parole for multiple reasons. First, he argued the parole board lost jurisdiction by not holding a duration review hearing, as required by Section 312110.1. Second, he argued that the failure to hold a timely duration review hearing, as required by Section 312110.1, violated due process. And then third, he argued Section 312110.1 is unconstitutional because it permits the executive branch, which is part of the New Mexico Corrections Department, to exercise judicial powers in violation of the separate powers of doctrine. And then two, it is unconstitutionally vague. And then third, it increases the penalty for a PFR without a jury making the necessary finding in violation of Apprendi versus New Jersey. And that's 530 U.S. Code 466 from the year 2000. And four, it violates the prohibition against double jeopardy. Now, this all sounds amazing to me.
It does to me as well. That's why I'm so disappointed. It does sound like very cogent and credible constitutional arguments.
So this is a consolidated appeal. The other person's name is Ronald Lusk. I see no need to go through the details about Lusk because they are so similar to Aragon's. And what did New Mexico Supreme Court decide ultimately?
Well, before we go there, I'd like to try to make sure I accurately describe our system a bit. PFR parole is covered by 3121-10.1, which was enacted in 2003 in a special session, and it took effect right away because it was deemed an emergency. And we had a counselor, a PFR. He was one of the only ones who did PFR-type evaluations and counseling back then. And he said that our five-year limitation on supervision, which was in the statute then, was just not enough because therapy for PFRs takes a very long time because they're in denial and they play evasive games and they just run out the clock. And he said that they needed a longer duration. Well, they didn't want to make the system any different for anybody except for PFRs. So thanks to Dr. Moss Aubrey's recommendations, all of a sudden we got indeterminate supervision for PFRs. And they said, well, how will we evaluate whether they're getting better or not and if they're responding to treatment? And he raised his hand and he says, well, we have instrumentation and tools where we can do that. And he sold a bill of goods. But the statute, as it was adopted, was amended in 2007 with an effective date of July 1, 2007. And the court stated that as a preliminary matter that they must decide which version of the statute applies and whether it makes a difference in their ultimate analysis.
So then what did they determine?
They stated, we have held that the law at the time of the commission of the offense is controlling. And they cited State versus Lucero and also State versus Ordonez. I don't have Ordonez, how to pronounce that. Holding that the retroactive application of a statute diminishing credit on a sentence violates the state and federal constitutional provisions against ex post facto laws. Aragon was convicted of committing sexual contact of a minor between the 6th day of June 2007 and the 7th day of June 2007. Thus, the 2004 version applies, because remember, the new revisions took effect for conduct after July 1, 2007. So the 2007 amendments were not in effect. Thus, on the other hand, was convicted of exploitation of children by manufacturing images between December 1, 07, remember July was the magic date, and July of 2008. Lust, therefore, was a subject to the amended and current version.
Now, the court then stated, the remaining preliminary question we answer is whether any difference in the two statutes affect the analysis of the issue before us in this case. We conclude they do not. Both versions command that the parole board reviews whether parole should continue after the initial 5 years of supervised parole and every 2.5 years thereafter.
And they noted that both versions also impose the burden of proving at each review hearing that the offender should remain on parole. But that's all it says. It doesn't say how you go about proving that. Although under differing standards, under the 2003 version, it says 2004, but it's the 2003 version, the state has the burden of proving to a reasonable certainty. And under the 2007 version, the Attorney General has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence. Both versions also expressly provide what happens if the state is unable to prove that the PFR should remain under parole supervision.
Would you do me the kind deed of telling me what the difference is between the two legal standards?
Well, I had that set up for Chance, and since he didn't make it, I decided to do some research, and I couldn't figure it out. So I called an attorney I worked for, and he said that legal certainty is not an evidentiary standard like preponderance of the evidence or beyond a reasonable doubt. Instead, it's a threshold standard applied in certain procedural contexts like this. Particularly, he said, in federal civil cases related to jurisdiction and the amount of damages. But he said it's not really a legal standard per se.
I see. So then what is the PFR's remedy under the law, regardless of the standard? They need to have a hearing according to the statute.
Yeah, but what's most important is that neither version sets forth any remedy for failure of the parole board to hold a duration review hearing when the initial 5-year period of supervised parole has been served, or the 2.5 years after that. Now, if you haven't had the first one, you're probably not going to get the subsequent. But there's nothing in the statute. There's no accountability. So it basically it's advice. A statute without any remedy is advice.
All right. Oh, I got you. Yeah. So let me read what the statute says. It states, when a PFR has served the initial 5 years of supervised parole and at 2.5-year intervals thereafter, the parole board shall review the duration of the PFR's supervised parole, and then at each hearing, the attorney general shall bear the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the PFR should remain on parole. Now, that doesn't really sound super ambiguous to me.
I don't see any ambiguity, but there's no remedy. It doesn't say what happens if they don't.
Yeah. And all right. Well, then apparently your Supreme Court did. They stated, for the following reasons, we conclude that the deadlines in Section 3121.10.1 are not jurisdictional. Most importantly, Section 3121.10.1 does not provide that parole ends if the hearing is not timely, nor does it provide any other consequence or penalty for noncompliance. In fact, there is nothing in the statute that prohibits the parole board from holding a duration review hearing after the prescribed deadline. Furthermore, the Probation and Parole Act contemplates that a PFR parolee who does not receive a timely duration review hearing is still subject to the supervision and orders of the parole board. Now, I mean, I don't really want to keep reading all of this.
Well, they went on to say, the parole board retains jurisdiction over the sex offender until they have performed the obligations of the person's release for the period of parole provided, at which time the board shall make a final order of discharge and issue a person a certificate of discharge. Finally, interpreting Section 3121-10.1 to automatically strip the parole board of jurisdiction for a missed deadline undermines the Parole and Probation Act's goal of a parole process facilitating the rehabilitation and reintegration of sex offenders under conditions tailored to each sex offender, with public safety weighing in the balance. Quote, we will not construe a statute to defeat this purpose. Now, it's amazing. It's amazing, and I'm calling out my liberal pointy heads because I think 3 of the 5 are definitely liberal pointy heads. I'm calling out my pointy-headed friends here on this. You say over and over again, all through your jurisprudence, you say that we construe the statute to mean what it says, and we won't read into it things that are not there. Well, I think that's what you just did here. The statute, to the point that it is clear, and it does have some ambiguity, but it is clear that these hearings have to happen. They would not put something in there, their hearing has to happen, if there were no consequence for it not happening. That would make that language superfluous and redundant, would it not?
I think so. I think I have a clip, Larry. I think this applies. Except for it didn't play. It was going to be the Scalia thing about purposivism.
Yes. Well, they wiggled their way out of this. And like I said, I think we've got, the Supreme Court has 5, not 7 or 9. But I think at least 3 of them are considered progressives. But this was a unanimous decision. There was no dissent. So I'm very disappointed.
And then they just said, as a result, the parole board's failure to hold timely duration review hearings did not strip it of the jurisdiction.
Very sad for us, because if I'm the parole board now, if I have sinister motivations and I want to build my prison population to get funding, and amazingly, people like to keep their agencies funded, I would say, well, you know, there's no consequence for us not having a hearing. We just get to have a bulging prison population and more funding. And what is the penalty? There is no penalty. And try passing a law now. Go out. You could spend 112 legislators right now. You wouldn't find a soul that would sponsor anything to fix this, because it would be cast in the media as figuring out how to get sex offenders out so they can do more harm. And they need to be locked up where they belong. This is a mess.
There's got to be all kinds of laws like this that they create the process and all that stuff, but then there's no teeth behind it. That okay, well they say F you, we're not going to do it, and okay, so yeah, go ahead and continue to not do it. There's no harm. There's nothing that's going to be done about it.
So well, but they don't realize that I'm not giving up. So I'm just going to put together a different lawsuit and come at it from a different direction. and say that the people need to be released on their release date. I've been wanting to do this, but I've been told I needed to hold my horses, that we've got this under control and we've got this brilliant litigation going. And they did argue a lot of the points that I wanted argued. But at this point now, we just need to put the brakes on them, keeping people in prison beyond their out date. And that is a liberty interest. And we're coming after you again. So don't think you've gotten away with this, because I'm working right now on trying to put together a new challenge.
Now, to simplify and boil this last 20 minutes down, it says if a PFR does not register, it's okay, just keep them on the registry with no consequences? Is that, I mean, would that be a remedy for a person? Like, hey, you didn't do your part, I won't do my part?
I don't think that'll work the same way.
You think they'll come at you?
I think they probably would.
But you could say, I guess that would get you, you would have standing in court, right?
You would, but there's a penalty for failing to register. This is something where there was nothing put in the statute to.
Sure. I gotcha. Just being kind of silly.
It was done in a haphazard, hurried up fashion in a special session. Special sessions don't have full staffing levels here. I don't know about other states, but here they don't. They usually have a proclamation issued by the governor. I want a bill that deals with this particular problem. Most of the time, the bill has largely been determined what it's going to say. So the legislators show up, they're in there for 1, 2, 3 days. They do a very minuscule amount of debate and review, and then they vote on it. And that's what they did. And this has been a junk since 2003. It took effect in 04, but it was actually passed in 03. Sure. Whatever. Gotcha. Anyway, but it's been on the books for 20 years. It's a mess. It always has been.
Well, all right then. I think that closes up shop, doesn't it?
Unless you had that other question from Big Mike you wanted to put in.
Let me roll back. Oh God, where was that? Right there. So Big Mike says, here's a quick question. I saw a post about a guy on Locals called the, do you think it's okay for me to give the guy, I don't want to give the guy any promotions. So I'm going to leave that out, but many of you will know the individual's name that I'm referring to. So can things like this be used to show that there are people out there using the registry for harassment?
Yes, and I've had time since we mic'd up and started recording here to think about it. And that would be something that you could use to encourage the states that don't have any laws to enact laws, because you see these disclaimers on the websites that says this information is not to be used to be harassing or to do all these things. But again, it's like what we just talked about. It's not actually a statute. It's just an advisory thing. But after seeing what's happening with how registry information is being used, I think you could build some support and possibly get a statute. Now, that's only one fraction of the problem, because you've got to have enforcement. That means that field officers have to be willing to take reports. They have to be willing to investigate reports. They have to be willing to send them to the district attorneys. Prosecutor's office recommending that prosecution ensue, and prosecutors who are elected have to be willing to undertake prosecutions. That's a lot of ifs. Yeah, because if I'm on the other side of this, what I would say, if I were a victim's advocate, I'd say, well, you know, it's kind of funny. We got a district attorney here claims to be taking care of the people here in our county. That district attorney's got put so much priority on trying to protect the people on the registry, and we've got 47 unsolved rape cases just in the last year, and there's kits sitting that haven't even been examined, and this person is putting all their emphasis on protecting the PFRs. Can you imagine how well that would go over politically?
Yeah, I totally understand how that would go. And then wouldn't there be a pretty hard burden of proof that's where the information came from? And that they're using it outside of just informing?
You got a good point there. It would be very easy to show where it came from, but true information is okay to disseminate. It's where they fabricate it and distort it is the problem. But we've long since decided that information that's true and it's publicly available can be re-disseminated. But it gets a little bit more tenuous when you put your own spin on it, when you put the flyer out that you pulled off the website. But if you put your own commentary on the flyer and putting out opinions about the dangerousness of this individual, you may be in a difficult territory there.
I see what you're saying. So just because it says that you are convicted of XYZ crime. That part's the factual part. And then when you start throwing that this person is dangerous because of these things and here's how they're dangerous and why, that's you throwing your own spin on it, huh?
That's my way of looking at it. It's when they start putting their own opinions, but merely disseminating your registry information. The problem we have is registry information should never be public. If we're going to have a registry, it should not be public. But good luck turning off the lights. They've been on for 20 plus years, almost 30 years.
Doubt.
How are you going to turn the lights off? You're not going to.
The internet does not forget. There's a hard drive stored all over the place with all this information on it. Yeah, you're not going to make it go away. And someone would then gain access to it. I don't know. Maybe we'll call it Palantir. And then they would disseminate it. Yes, well, Palantir. I just made up that name.
Well, my limited knowledge, what I would imagine would happen would be that the private operators that have scooped up all this information through the years, they would make sure that it continued to linger for years and years and decades to come.
Sure. Totally. And
so you're not going to escape that. As long as we have freedoms that we have in this country, there's a downside. And one of them is that true information, regardless of how ugly it is, can be put out. And that's why I've advocated to the powers that be at NARSL that we do the same thing. I'd like to see websites built. I'd like to go through divorce case proceedings. Almost everybody's had some kind of cases in their life, whether it be civil or criminal, and the files are full of juicy stuff, particularly in divorces. So the people that are our detractors, if I were pulling all the shots, I would have websites of you exposing all of your divorce dirty laundry about what your spouse accused you of doing, and that's merely disseminating information that's in a public file. There wouldn't be squat you could do about it, and that's what you'd be dealing with if I were pulling the strings.
You're mean. You're dirty, man. That's all I gotta say.
Well, I'm playing with the same game that they're playing. They've built websites, they've been doxing people, and we'd get into the doxing business, except we would do it better.
Are we done?
I think so.
All right. Head over to registrymatters.co for show notes and links to the shop, which you could do at fypeducation.org/shop, and head up and check out all of our fabulous merch. And if you want to send an email message, registrymatterscast@gmail.com is that address. You want to leave some old-fashioned voicemail, and I will try to remember to play it on the show. 747-227-4477. And then if you would like to be one of the fabulous people that support us on Patreon, that is patreon.com/registrymatters. Thank you, everybody, that has joined us to listen to the live stream. You are some of the best people on the planet. And Larry, thank you very much, as always. And I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.